From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
New York's new mayor is getting serious about cleaning up the violence in his city, but does he face an obstacle in Manhattan's district attorney? Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial writer Manay Ukweberua. Two New York City police officers were fatally shot last week responding to a domestic violence call, and two civilians in recent weeks have been randomly pushed onto the subway tracks. One of those civilians died after being hit by an arriving train. This was at a Times Square subway stop, and Times Square used to be a gritty place in New York, but at least not in my memory. New York Mayor Eric Adams has recently said that the city is dealing with a sea of violence, and not even his honor feels safe in the subways. Listen to this.
Day one, I took the subway system. I felt unsafe. I saw homeless everywhere. People were yelling on the trains. There was a feeling of disorder. So as we deal with the crime problem, we also have to deal with the fact people feel unsafe. That's the dual battle that I have. Because if we don't do them both together, then we fail. I'm going to deal with the crime, but I'm also going to make people feel safe on their system.
Kim, that struck me as a remarkable statement from New York's mayor, and I don't know if you remember old New York. I've seen photos of the 70s and 80s, but I certainly don't recall it.
Yeah, so I obviously didn't grow up in New York, but I went to college in New Jersey at the beginning of the 1990s. Things were starting to change then, but I still remember going in on the weekends, and there were definitely parts of Manhattan you didn't want to be around, even Times Square. They were dodgy, and there's a definite feeling of that again. And in some ways, it's even worse. It's not just in different areas, but the types of crimes. And I think the most important thing that the mayor said there is that people simply feel unsafe, even in safe areas of the city, because everything feels so haphazard, because there has been such a pullback among district attorneys and other prosecutors. There are so many people out there at large that shouldn't be. And this is going to be the biggest test for Eric Adams. At least he understands that. And he is finally, it looks like, moving to do something in the wake of these recent police shootings.
One thing substantively that Adams is talking about is reconstituting this plainclothes anti-gun team. It was disbanded in 2020 under Mayor Bill de Blasio. According to the New York Post, there were about 600 people in this unit. It was an undercover anti-crime unit. And the argument for disbanding that is that it was behind a disproportionate number of complaints and shootings, or at least that's how the New York Post coverage explains it. So Adams is talking about bringing that unit back, having better training, having body cameras and so forth, and so making some reforms and some changes to it. Manay, you covered the mayoral election in New York. I think you interviewed Eric Adams. Is this the kind of thing that he was elected by New Yorkers to do?
This is exactly what Eric Adams was elected by New Yorkers to do. He distinguished his campaign during the Democratic primary in the mayor's race by early focusing on the crime problem and saying that he, as a former police officer, was the person who had the best experience and the most commitment to actually turn things around. But the biggest concrete promise he made during that campaign was to reinstate the plainclothes unit. So as you said, Bill de Blasio and his police commissioner, Dermot Shea, disbanded the unit in the summer of 2020. This was just after the George Floyd protests, kind of during the height of the wave of defunding and generally restricting police action. And their goal was to reduce the number of police encounters. Eric Adams saw the folly in that approach, basically knowing we can't just have beat officers on the streets sort of reacting to calls when they come in about violence. We need to have officers who are proactively on the streets encountering people in dangerous neighborhoods and helping to get illegal guns removed. And so if there's any single policy during the early part of Adams' anti-crime agenda that people should be evaluating him on, it should be him speedily and successfully reinstating those plainclothes units. And we'll see if it can make a difference in terms of the rates of crime that we're seeing on the streets.
One challenge here for Adams, though, seems to me the district attorney that was recently elected for Manhattan. His name is Alvin Bragg. And shortly after the new year, he put out this memo explaining the policies that he was going to pursue, including charges that he did not intend to prosecute, including resisting arrest, obstructing arrest, fair jumping, and so forth. And Kim, what's notable here is that he's his own duly elected public officer. He doesn't take orders from Eric Adams. And so that puts a challenge here and some tension between these two people who are both responsible for keeping New Yorkers safe.
Correct. And it's notable that among the things that Eric Adams said he was going to do, one was obviously reestablishing these anti-crime police units. Two other things that I think are important because they go to that the other offices or other branches where he's stuck to a degree simply pressuring people to do what he'd like them to do. But one thing he said, he's going to pressure Albany and prosecutors to reform the bail laws that are currently in existence. He also says he's going to appoint judges who will be willing to prosecute crimes. And while I'll note that all Mr. Adams has there is pressure, he also has a huge podium, and notably other voices have been rising to that podium as well to really start stepping up attacks on Bragg. Just on Friday, it was quite remarkable. We had the amazing funeral of Jason Rivera, one of the police shot in the last week, and his widow spoke, and she actually called out Bragg while she was there complaining about the laws that were allowing bad guys to go right back out onto the streets. And it has had a little bit of an impact. Alvin Bragg has slightly walked back some of those original proposals he put out. Most recently, he has promised that he will, in fact, aggressively prosecute gun-related crimes, including simply for possession, which was something that originally said he was not going to go after. So the power of pressure and of the podium can make a difference. We'll see where Mr. Bragg goes next.
We have a couple clips from that funeral that Kim mentioned. This is on Friday. It's the memorial service for Jason Rivera. He's a 22-year-old rookie cop. He was killed when he got this domestic dispute call on Friday. First, here's New York Police Commissioner Keechance Seawell.
The criminals in this city who would victimize and instill fear in innocent people, who would seek to harm any police officer and rip away two promising protectors, sons, brothers, and a husband from their families and friends. Those who seek to dim the beacons of hope across these five boroughs, look outside. Hear our voices. See the presence in this cathedral. The NYPD will never give up this city. We will always prevail.
And also speaking, there was Rivera's widow, who seemed to blame the DA Bragg for the kind of policies that created this environment. Listen to this.
The system continues to fail us. We are not safe anymore. Not even the members of the service. I know you were tired of these laws, especially the ones from the new DA. I hope he's watching you speak through me right now.
So, Monet, do you agree with Kim here that even though Eric Adams, the mayor, can't tell the DA what to do, the mayor has a big microphone and can make a case about these policies to the public?
He certainly has that, and he's been extremely willing to use it, both between his election last year and his inauguration, and this month kind of taking his first steps as mayor of the city, trying to reinstate policies that will help clean up New York City streets. I actually was in Midtown on the same day as the funeral for Jason Rivera, very close to St. Patrick's Cathedral, and I saw waves of officers leaving the cathedral after the ceremony. I asked him what he thought about what had preceded. And he, told me that he was at the funeral for Jason Rivera, which I thought was remarkable that he would assume that I would know who that was. And I think he was onto something there. New Yorkers are really paying attention to these crimes in ways that maybe they would have flown under the radar before, when we didn't have a mayor who was as willing to focus on them and bring them to the forefront. But in terms of the results that Eric Adams is able to deliver, yeah, it's going to require him to be very vocal and to speak against some of the people in his own party who would rather divert attention away from the crime wave, who would rather point out that rates haven't risen anywhere close to where they've been, where they were in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s. That's true, but we are still seeing a historic rise. As long as we have people who are resisting good faith efforts to restore policing, it's going to take a lot of pressure and a lot of wherewithal for him to be able to accomplish the changes they seek.
But one indication of who's winning this debate, it seems to me, is, Kim, you mentioned a moment ago that the DA, Alvin Bragg, has begun to backtrack a little bit. And listen to this. This is a remarkable clip, I think.
I understand why those who read my memo of January 3rd have been left with the wrong impression about how I will enforce New York's laws. I take full accountability for that confusion caused by the memo. It was unclear and legalistic, put out into the public domain, and left many New Yorkers justifiably concerned for how we will keep them safe.
And Kim, what I find interesting about that is he seems to be blaming this on a communications issue, that the memo was released, it was too legalistic, people didn't understand it, and he's going to do a better job of explaining what he intends to do in the future. He doesn't seem to be grappling with why people were concerned about what the memo said.
Right. And where have we heard that exact line before? Do you remember only a few weeks ago, the Philadelphia district attorney ended up in hot water over some comments he'd made suggesting there was no crime problem in his city. And then when he was called out on that quite vocally by a number of former politicians and local activists, his original response was, oh, you just didn't understand what I was trying to say, and the media misinterpreted me. He then went on to more abject apology. And look, the reason I mention him is that we're seeing this across the country. Something really important happened back around Thanksgiving with that Waukesha tragedy, the parade in which a guy who was out on bail mowed down all of those people. And up until that moment, almost all of the attention had been on the defund the police movement and the real problems that was causing and feeding into crime across the country. But Waukesha caused people to take a second look at the much broader issue of these bail laws, these prosecutors who refused to go after those who are in the crime and put them in jail. Police had been talking about this for a long time, but the public hadn't really caught on. And it's now becoming a huge theme. And you're looking at these prosecutors across the country, and they're all backtracking to a certain degree, trying to justify themselves, whether it's Chesa Boudin out in San Francisco or Gascon in L.A. or Krasner in Philadelphia or here Bragg. There's still a long way to go. These policies have been a decade in the making, if not more, and most of them are not technically and officially changing course, but they're certainly on the defensive at the moment.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
Your Money Briefing will explore what you need to know to become a homeowner and how to sustain your home by learning ways to manage the costs from unexpected expenses.
You're basically always in a state of checking. You're always keeping your eye open for anything that could be going wrong with your house. Your house is a complicated machine. It has a lot of systems and components in it, and those systems and components are getting older. They're wearing out.
You can get early access to our series, Buying a Home and Keeping It, on WSJ Special Access. Only for WSJ subscribers.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Monet, before the break, Kim was saying that a lot of these prosecutors, these progressive prosecutors, have begun at least starting to change course a little bit. And do you think that that's the case and that the debate over crime and policing is changing within the Democratic Party? It seems to me that there was a real defund the police wave and some politicians jumped aboard that. And some of them are now trying to jump off it and thinking maybe it wasn't the good idea that they thought it was at the time.
Well, it's certainly changing. You have seen Democrats at the national level and in cities backtrack on some of their most explosive rhetoric that we saw beginning in the summer of 2020 after the George Floyd killing. A lot of the cities that promised to defund their police departments have reinstated funding. That includes New York City, where Mayor de Blasio wanted to slash $1 billion from the NYPD budget. That has largely been restored. You also saw in Minneapolis, after there was a referendum to replace the police department with a new organization that would sort of reduce the amount of proactive enforcement and replace it with some social services. They, you know, voters rejected that and they decided to maintain the police department largely as it is. And so you are seeing Democrats realize that they were, you know, basically getting killed at the polls by voters who were angry about the amount of crime that had increased and wanted to make sure that streets remain safe. But at the same time, sort of, there are still very potent progressive forces sort of within the Democratic Party that are making it impossible to return to sort of a pro-police status quo. I've been following one piece of legislation moving through Washington today. Representative Josh Gottheimer, a congressman from New Jersey, introduced a bill which would fund small local police departments. He has several co-signers from within the Democratic Party and some Republican co-sponsors as well. It would do very limited things like helping to sort of make sure that these officers are staffed and, you know, improving some of their training practices. And yet it seems to have gotten very little coverage and very little take up within the Democratic Party. And I think that that just goes to show that party leaders and the National Party as a whole are still wary of explicitly embracing police officers, giving them the resources they need to do the job and affiliating themselves with the cause of reducing crime.
And just one more thought on this. The Bragg memo, for example, says they're not going to prosecute fare jumping. And I understand that people think that that's a minor issue. But Kim, correct me if I'm wrong, wasn't the whole theory of what turned around New York in the 1990s this broken windows theory that if minor disorder, petty crimes, graffiti, things like that are allowed to proliferate, that they will lead to and encourage more serious crimes?
Yeah, absolutely. That was entirely the idea behind it. It was embraced by Rudy Giuliani, obviously, who implemented that theory throughout the police force, got a commissioner who did. You know, and I remember very much it being focused at the time on the squeegee guys. Remember the people who you'd stop at the light, they'd kind of harass you to pay them to wash your windshield. It wasn't necessarily crime, but it was sort of harassment to a certain level, in some places, extortion. And I remember the pushback against that at the time was, well, you don't really get rid of this, you just push it to other areas. And actually what we found was that it did result in huge areas of New York, more widespread, seeing a reduction in crime. And yeah, we talk about this in all kinds of different forms. It's natural to human understanding. We talk about it, for instance, about earmarks in Washington being a gateway drug to worse bad habits. And that is the situation, whether you're talking about politicians willing to spend like drunken sailors or criminals who begin at small levels, but when they're tolerated, the crimes increase.
A couple other thoughts on how New York's new mayor is doing. Monet, I was a little bit surprised to see Eric Adams endorse this bill passed by New York City to allow non-citizens to vote in local elections. And it's true that there is inevitably going to be a lawsuit over this. Maybe it will get blocked. Maybe a court will say that New York City is not allowed to do this under the New York State Constitution. But I was taken by surprise that Eric Adams went in for this thing, given that it seems to me it would not be a popular issue among voters as a whole. There's a group, usually probably on the Democratic side, that would be very excited and positive about this proposal. But if you tell other people that you can vote in New York, all you have to do is live here, have some kind of work authorization, and have 30 days of residency, I think most people would say no to that. And so, you know, from your coverage of the mayoral race, did that strike you as a surprise that Adams would endorse that?
Well, it certainly struck me as bad policy for all the reasons that you laid out. It would be one of the most progressive voting structures that we've seen in any city in the country, maybe the most, and certainly for a very large city, to allow just about everybody to vote, even if they, you know, are very short-term residents and haven't, you know, sort of integrated into society and gone into the formal process of earning citizenship. So that seems like it would give a lot of voters pause, the idea that it's that easy for someone to go and cast a ballot and weigh in on the biggest decisions that the city faces. But I honestly can't say that it surprised me that Eric Adams would go for it. And that's in part because he bills himself as sort of a tribune of immigrants, a tribute of, you know, people living in the city on the fringes. And it really was some of those communities that delivered him into City Hall in the first place. I saw him speak in Queens at a rally of Chinese and Korean Americans, many of whom were enthusiastically supporting him. And if you look at the poll numbers from the Democratic primary race in New York City, most of his support came from people in the outer boroughs which often have very large immigrant communities of all types. And so Eric Adams identifies with these people. He sees it as a base of support. And so you can imagine him kind of weighing the costs and benefits of embracing a policy that would broaden the amount of people from these immigrant communities who are able to cast votes, and thinking that it was to some degree to his benefit. So we'll see where that policy goes, whether the courts weigh in, whether it gets curtailed to some degree.
The other issue that I've had my eye on, Kim, is charter schools. And I remember, if I'm remembering correctly, the primary, Eric Adams was not the anti-charter schools candidate. And I understand also that he's had his hands full dealing with this violence. And yet New York is getting ready to pass a budget, and there's a cap on charter schools that is binding. And we have not heard a whole lot from Eric Adams about that issue.
Yeah, I really wish he would get on this too, because there's a lot of things that he could do immediately that would really, really help. And one example of this is expanding the co-location of charter schools. So right now, New York is required to provide rental assistance to charters that are denied public space. But co-location is a much better, more cost-effective way to go forward, basically allowing charters to use space in underused district school buildings. Back in Michael Bloomberg's last 5 years as mayor, he approved some 150 locations, but under the tenure of Bill de Blasio, who was obviously extremely hostile to charters and took all of his orders from teachers' unions, that number fell to 59. So there's a lot of unused space in New York City, and the mayor gets to appoint 9 of the 15 members of the panel that approves these requests. There are a lot of requests pending, so that is one thing he could do really quick. The other thing he could do, though, too, especially you mentioned Albany and how they're getting ready to do a budget, but he can start using that podium we talked about to begin lobbying Albany very loudly and publicly to raise the cap on the number of charter schools. They're currently stuck at 290. There is enormous amount of waiting. There's a waiting list right now of 48,000 children. So if you had some more of those charter slots, you could offer a lot more of these parents and their children a new lifeline to having more choice over their schools and better education.
And again, it seems to me that this is an issue that would upset a portion of the Democratic Party's base, but would be very broadly popular in a city like New York, where there are a lot of kids already in charter schools. And of course, parents are choosing those charter schools. They want their kids to be there. So, Manet, I mean, do you agree? Is my memory right that Eric Adams was not the anti-charter school candidate? And do you think there's hope for him to take a really strong stand on this issue?
Well, I think you put that exactly the right way. He was not the anti-charter school candidate, but I don't think he necessarily took very strong positions during the primary race, sort of holding himself to improving sort of the status quo for charter schools. He remained open to it. He said that they provide a good value to students in the city, many of whom are desperate for a better education. But I think he, like most of the other Democratic candidates, sort of was afraid of the power of the teachers unions and didn't want to put himself on the record too early saying that he definitely was committed to sort of expanding charter space in the city. And so we will see. Again, it's good. You know, we're very early in his administration now. I think Kim's right to say the sooner the better, because the longer he waits, the more the status quo gets baked in. But it's possible that sort of if he has the right conversations with the right advocates and sees not only that it would be beneficial for students in the city, but that it would be very politically popular, that he will be willing to take some of that flack from the teachers unions. But he, you know, he's going to have to prepare for that battle, because it won't come easily.
Thank you, Manet. Thank you, Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. And if you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.